Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I am with my dear friend, Kỳ Phong Pa Tran. I had to do that a few times to get that name right. Paul and I actually go way back. We go back over 30 years, three decades. We were both young Vietnamese Catholics, and we went to all these camps, like at Chai Hai Nam Tin at El Dorado Park here, right by down the street here. You actually came by my restaurant, Saigon Street in Westwood at UCLA, during the years that I had it. And throughout the years, we would run into each other at all these events. And I consider you a literary gangster, a writer, a Vietnamese-American culturalist who can really talk about many things Vietnamese-American. And most recently, the LA Times piece about the Fast and Furious. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a dream come true to be here. Bucket list item for me.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
You're not just saying that, are you?
No. Took 500 episodes for me to get here, guys.
So funny. Yeah. You know, you have actually been instrumental throughout the years. I've come to you about my writing. I haven't had the courage to finish yet, but the question for me in the last few years is like, why write? Why am I writing? It's occupying my brain all the time. Why should we learn how to write? And why should I be writing? Why should anybody write when we have AI now? And as a writer yourself, as somebody who won Teacher of the Year in 2024, and we're going to talk about that. But as somebody who teaches the craft of filmmaking, of writing, why is this important that we as humans continue the legacy of writing?
Okay, so I'm going to pause. I want to just say the origin of me writing, like in my modern life, because I think it's really important to your answer. So I'm going to really get this really quick. It's a probably pretty classical Asian American story of how I became a writer. I think that will hopefully answer your question. Mm-hmm. So in the early 2000s, I finished UCLA. In the early 2000s, I finished UCLA, and I moved to the Bay Area, and I was working in politics. I worked for a city council member, and then my brother was going to go to law school, and when you're a social science major, that's a pretty natural course. Like, okay, I'm going to do this for a couple of years, and I'm going to go to law school, and then finish some kind of practice. It just felt safe. It felt like the right thing to do, very conservative, traditional route to become this professional, right? Especially as coming from a refugee family that didn't have a lot of money. And then when I was working there in a government building, 9/11 happened. And it just changed my whole perspective on, you know, one day you could be in LSAT class like I was, or one day you could be in an office building, and then, you know, the next day it could be taken away from you. Like, what do you really want to do with your life? And I was like, oh, what do I really want to do with my life? But I wanted to be a writer. I've always known since I was like 12 years old, you know, and at UCLA, I was in a theater group called LCC, and I wrote plays in that group. And I just always liked that feeling.
Like, I got to stop you real quick. Yeah. LCC.
Legendary.
Yeah. Randall Park, Ali Wong. All Christina these big Wong. Names, Christian Wong, yeah. Jenny Trang Le, a lot of people,
Hugh Ho,
all these big names in the Asian American media.
Who knew, right?
Came from this small club coming out of UCLA. Yeah. And I'm, you know, in your
part of it. It's awe-inspiring, because we just thought we were playing. And it's probably maybe that was the safe space for it, right? The safe space for other Asian American creatives.
But all these important creatives come from that. They didn't come from a USC club. They came from this UCLA, student club. It was mind blowing.
So I always liked that feeling of writing. Then I did like high school journalism, but I never told anybody, you know. And I actually wrote a play about, that's one of my plays in LCC, was about coming out, but the coming out was coming out as an artist too. The character's Vietnamese parents. And like, I don't want to go to law school, which I'm kind of like telling, right? And I think in the play, I don't want to go to law school. I want to go to get my MFA. And then along the way, I actually had another decision to make. I was interested equal in like fine arts photography and creative writing. And then so I made that choice to, you know, study very traditionally. I think in this podcast, like, I hopefully like young people who are interested in writing, because I am a teacher. I want to like kind of give them the steps and also inspire them. I went to community college in Oakland at Laney College. I'm going to see my professor in a couple weeks, so we still keep in touch. Then I just did all the, like, these writing programs. I was in a Vietnamese artist collective in the Bay Area, Kearney Street Workshop. These are like the traditional Asian American like training grounds. And I got my MFA from UC Riverside in creative
writing. Did you do your MA first or MFA first?
Fun fact, I actually have an MA in Asian American Studies and an MFA in creative writing. There's like a gap, but the first two degrees at UCLA, I just went all the way through. And I'm being fully honest, I just like to be as transparent as possible. I was not a great graduate student. I was really immature. I was one of those kids where your parents push you into school. So I graduated high school at 17. I started grad school when I was 21. So I was just totally not equipped for grad school and beyond the first time. I was like really immature. And I'm very thankful for the professors for bearing with me. Mm-hmm. And I hope I've atoned for my sins back then, because I was not a good graduate student. I was a graduate student acting like an undergrad.
That's interesting that you do the Asian American Studies first and then you get the MFA. And the reason that's interesting to me is because I study this stuff. I love when craftspeople who do their fine art, their photography, their painting, their filmmaking, when they have this social justice background, like Asian American Studies, it rounds you out.
It's you nailed it. I have been fascinated with my cohort and the graduates around me. And at the time, people would always say the same thing, like, what are you going to do with that, right? And so I'll give you some examples. Ali Wong was an Asian American Studies major, and she became a comic and a movie star. And then there's this guy named Jim Liao. He was an Asian American Studies major. He founded Formula Drift, and now he's the president of the Long Beach Grand Prix. So like the range of what you could do is just a lens. And it's a very, very social justice oriented lens, right? It's towards providing the regular things in the regular world with an emphasis on Asian Americans who don't have access and don't have all the resources to these things.
It's crazy. We talked about like, why is college even important anymore? Because my brother and I, we talk about that with the age of AI, with the age of YouTube videos, and you can really learn to do whatever you need to do online.
So this goes back to your original question, right? So in terms of like, why is writing important? I was trained this, so I believe in it as well, but writing is refined thinking. Mm. So when people say, is writing important, just translate it to say, is thinking important? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, the answer is like a no-brainer. So when we say like, can the machine write? The machine can put words down, but can the machine put down original words? Well, first of all, we know that because it's a LLM, it's a large language model, it is only taking from what's already been written. And the whole premise of art and even commerce is new things. So if you're amalgamizing old things over and over, if nobody made anything new, the system would be like, it'd be like eating space food, and then you have to recycle, you know, what happens after you eat, right? Like, how can it be original? And I'm not sure. So to me, and also, like I said, you know, off camera, writing is between people. Art is between people. So if you use the tool, like, is it really communicating with, is it between person to person? And I don't know. Now, can it make a manual? Yeah. But is that the same as
creative art? Writing?
Yeah, creative writing, sharing your emotions and expressing. I mean, I don't think so, but I'm not 100% anti-AI, but in the creative space, I don't think it's doing the same thing at all. Like. Yeah. And there's like a fine line, especially like in film, you know, I teach film, you make film. There's like this great debate, like some people say you should have extras, right? Human extras. And then some people say, well, why don't we just CGI them in? And then there's like a back and forth, right? If you're an extra, you get this stage experience. And then maybe you become a movie star later on. And then the CGI people are like, but you save so much money not bringing on the people, or you don't have to pay for this, and you can use it for other means, right? So I don't know how that expresses itself in writing. It will always matter. Writing will always matter. The arts will always matter. Like, even though a lot of times, like, the experiences are the same, like, they're for their time, right? Somebody mom passed away in 1900. It's very sad, but it feels distant. Somebody's mom passes away in 2026 and you write about it and somebody you know, or the context is the same, or they go to the same restaurants. It makes you feel seen. It makes you feel less lonely. So that's that's the connection that the machines can't do.
When I think about machine writing and I think about the construction as a scaffold, to get me to where I feel free to express what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But the danger of that, what I've been going through in the last few years when I write, is that when that scaffolding is there, it's hard for me to say, you know, I'm going to remove the scaffolding, because the scaffolding is really beautiful. It's like kind of integral in the writing composition.
So I'll say this, because I'm in multiple writing groups with people who just like suffer for this. And at least for the creative itself, we love that. Like I want to do all the steps. There's like this thing, you know, a lot of writers have been get caught using AI. There's like major scandals last week, major scandals that haven't even come out yet. People getting kicked out of programs, people. And I was thinking to myself, like, why would you want to skip that? And that's my own personality. And what I mean by that is, if you're a cook, right? Like we both know Chef David. Don't you want to learn and be creative and try experiment, and then you mess up a bunch of times and then you finally make this one good thing? And then on the 100th try, you're so proud of yourself. Do you want to make like the best thing on your first try? Like, I don't know if first of all, you can't make the best thing on your first try, but like cheating yourself of all that process, right? I don't want to call it suffering, but the learning of it, it doesn't feel right. Because that's the whole part of being an artist is like learning, like trial and error, and I think, playfulness.
I think if we ever lose that as human beings, I think that's when we're going to be in hot water.
Yeah. Like we always thinking about the product and the end, but like the steps of like every time I make a discovery, I'm going to shout out Kathy Linche, who's my writing coach. I text her or my writing group. I'm like, I figured this out about my story. I figured this out. Like, it's so exciting. Like nobody's excited. I'm excited, you know? Like in my essay, the Corolla essay, like, you know, you write it and then you add this line and you add that line. And then later on this, like take this line out and you get so excited. Like, why would you take that away from you? I'm being serious. Why would you take that away from yourself? Like, okay, this end product and a lot of people read it. That was not the most exciting. I'm being honest. That was cool. Professionally is cool, but like my two editors helped me so much. That was cool, right? Showing my friends before I got published, that was cool. Believing in it a year ago when nobody took the pitch. So I'm gonna fast forward to the story. Nobody took the pitch and I sat on it. I was like, man, nobody wants this story, but I think it's a good story. I just kept thinking, Fast and the Furious, JDM cars. I have my new car. Like, how can I make this work?
Wow.
And then I was like, I sent it out. Nobody wanted it because it's too far away. I was like a year from now, but I thought a year ahead. I was like, the anniversary is June 21st. I sent the pitch July 2025. And then I sent it out again in March. Somebody wanted it.
Did you know anybody? Yeah. Or did you just cold?
No. And this is me being an established writer. This is not even, they're not cold emails. These are emails to editors I've worked with. Because we're writing, I'm trying to write about a world that like the mainstream editors, they're not in this world. Like that's my point, is I want to like shine a light on places you may not have been or seen, right? Like that's the beauty of this.
Yeah.
So, but the fact that nobody believed in it and then it kind of picked up from there, like I'll give you an example. Say my dad was Patrick Shung, the owner of the LA Times, and I wrote this, he put it in. Is that exciting?
Yeah.
It's not exciting at all. It's like is automatic. Why getting things automatic is not exciting to me. The fact that this organically bubbled up and here I am with you.
Yeah.
Is come on. That you know, AI this? You're gonna AI this? Yeah. I get to be with Kenneth because somebody randomly believed in my Corolla essay. Like it's just boop, 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 boop. That's how it works.
And you told me about the serendipity of meeting, you know, Chris Strand over at Little Saigon. And tell me about that. Tell us about it.
So my essay ends with this mechanic named Viet, who has a body shop, auto mechanic shop in Little Saigon. And he was doing modifications on my car. Just because I wanted them, but also because I was writing the story and I was going to take my car to car shows and I wanted to like hang out with the car people and interview them. And so when I was at his shop in Garden Grove, I was going to grade papers that day, but the office was closed. And they're like, hey, two blocks over is a copy shop. Everybody swears by it. I said, okay, I'll walk over there. And I was grading papers. And then Chris and another woman pull up, park right in front, and they walk in. And I go, hey, I know you from Little Saigon Official. He's like, hey, let me grab some coffee. He sits down and we talk. And then he's like, he's telling me, I was like, oh yeah, my car, what are you doing here? My car's getting lowered at the shop. He's like, do you know who that is? And then he told me his name, and then I Googled it, and then I was like, oh wow, like this guy is like a legit iconic racer, wow. Right? Not just the first time I went, they're like, oh, they race, but that doesn't mean anything. But then they dropped the names, right? Team Wicked, The Doctor, and then you Google these people and they're like the fastest. They really were the fastest, and they really were the most furious Hondas in the world at the time, you know? And I was like, oh, what a perfect ending. So it was like, I feel like the universe brought that to me. Like, cause I think it's the end, without that ending, I don't think it's
And you left his name out.
Yeah, because he was very shy about it when I mentioned it. He was like, oh, that was the old days. That was the old days. So definitely if he wants to be in stories in the future, I would. But I don't think it actually kind of works cooler that way to not know his name.
Yeah, people are like hunting him down. But you also left out the woman that Chris Tran, her name is Professor Talha.
Yes.
And Professor Talha has been on this podcast a few times, and she's coming out with a new book later in the year.
Yeah. Vala President.
Vala President, yeah. Another legendary person.
And I told her as well, I was a former Vala board member, former VIF committee chair and stuff like that.
So. Yeah. It's crazy how things come full circle. And now that we're both fathers, right? When we think about like the importance of thinking things through on paper and seeing the way these young kids consume content now, it's kind of unnerving for me when I think that, I don't know how your children are, but the ability to think deeper than they need to, is it even important for them anymore? I mean, the answer has got to be yes, but
there's a balance, right? That's the balance that we try to have in our family. Like, we're not going to be able to stop them on YouTube or social media, but there has to be amounts of that. And in my house, everybody's a reader. My kids grew up readers. I take them where every time we go on a family vacation, the first place we go is to a bookstore. So it's culturally part of our family. We go to libraries, we go to literary events, and so we go to museums. So to balance that out, I don't think you can ever like negate the electronics, but they also love to read manga. They love, you know, like I grew up loving to read comic books. I just think like you got to find age appropriate stuff, personality appropriate stuff. And so it's a mix, right? I don't think if you do like, oh, you can only read and never watch TV. That's like, remember how our parents were, it's like, even with three channels, we were watching, you know, addicted to, we would just watch those like Maury Povich's and stuff like that. So it's like, if you're saying, oh, there's trash now, I was like, we were watching trash back then too, or the Judge shows, or come on now, like, you know, we weren't consuming like the good calories back then.
So true. Yeah. And when I think about my kids now, I try to push them into like, I grew up at 13 driving delivery vans for my parents' business. And at 15, I took a cross-country trip with two other guys from church who they couldn't drive at the time. And none of us were legal to drive, but I drove. 15 years old, drove in a car. And I'm trying to like really calibrate that to how do I allow my children to do all these, I mean, street living, dangerous things that we kind of like went through.
No, it's never going to happen.
You don't think so?
No. We, in the best way possible, we provided more for our kids. You know, and I'll give you an example. Since this is the Vietnamese podcast, I grew up a shop boy. My dad had a furniture store. Some of my best memories, it will definitely be in some kind of story, is being in the back of a furniture store. Not the front. The front is the showroom. The back, it was like a real parkour, real adventure. And that was my summer camp. So now that I have a different life, my kids go to summer camp. And I don't think that's bad, man. I don't think they have to necessarily. Now, are they going to have as much grit,
texture,
and street toughness, and all that? Yeah. No, of course not. And but they're also going to like not have to worry about getting mugged, getting jumped, getting into fights at the park, like, you know, like all, there's like a lot of craziness that we grew up with, man. Like getting hit up. I don't know. So it's a balance, right? Like, but there's no way they're going to, like, we want them to have that, but I don't, we want them to have that toughness, but I don't think we want them to be the environment that raised that toughness, because that environment's hard, man. I'll be honest, like, that environment's hard.
Everything you touch and do today revolves around writing. Everything you do, everything you do, whether you're teaching high school students, you're teaching guys like me what to think when I'm like putting a book together. You're thinking about writing for an LA Times piece. You are also teaching young people how to think about what to write in an essay when they're applying for colleges and moving on in life.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together, we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H-Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
Some of the most important things that, even as a 50-year-old, we're the same age, we're almost 2 months apart.
And we look good, too. We look good. We look good, right?
At our age, when I think about what is important, you're actually helping young people think about why there's certain things about the way we live that's so important to people who are reading our file, our application in life. What is important about, so when I hear that you write and you teach and you guide young people to write their essays to get into college, I try to think about, like, what is so important these days that somebody who, on the other side, who's reading this stuff is going to be like, I like that person.
That's a great question. And I'll say this. In this world, you said I'm like a Vietnamese culturalist or, you know.
You're a Vietnamese American culturalist.
Yeah. But I'll say this. The most important thing we can all be is to be a humanist. Right? To be interested in other people, to care about other people, care about yourself, be interested in yourself, right? And so as curmudgeonly as people say I am at home, at work, I do have a sincere just fascination in with people, right? Like, I want to know, like, about their lives, and I want to know what makes them tick, and I want to know these experiences. So when you say, like, how do you show yourself in the writing? It has to come back, like, people say, oh, authenticity, right? But that's a very generic term. Yeah. Like, it is a true, but it's like you are authentic by sharing your very specific experiences, your emotions when you went through that experience, your reflection on those experiences, right? And then, like, to the craft part is, like, how you control the language of it, like, which words you use. Simple lessons like diction equals tone, which is the words you choose creates the tone of your piece. Goes back to, like, the heart of, like, AP English class, that your audience, who is your intended audience, affects your tone. So the way you talk in church to the priest is different from when you talk to your homeboys when you're out drinking. And then, and that's how you kind of, like, cater it. Now, when you write for, like, a general audience, like, there's, like, a neutral tone. But even, like, I feel like when I write, I got the greatest compliment from my writing teacher, Susan Strait. I mean, world famous novelist. She said, after my Corolla essay, she said, only you could have written that. And I was like, what does that mean, right? Like, first of all, it's a great compliment. Thank you, Susan. What does that mean? Like, you share this sequence of stories that, like, nobody else had.
Can put together.
And then could, and then to like pace it out. And obviously the luck with meeting Viet. And then I do want to just add like some background to that piece was like since you're asking is, there's some cool background to the Corolla essay, which is one, my mom used to work on the street called Susanna, which is like right off the 710. And I would go with her to work and it would just be blown up, just skid marks. And I knew what was happening there, right? Well, it turns out Susanna runs perpendicular to Maria Street. And Maria Street is one of the legendary race streets.
Oh, wow.
So that was one, like even since I was like a little kid, I was like exposed to this. So these are like the little details that like add to the story, right? Like you can't just be like, oh, I went to the races, right? But it's like, oh, my mom, like as a child would take me there.
Connective
right?
tissue.
Yeah. And then another fun fact that's not in the piece, I made a documentary about import cars in college. And my TA was Justin Lin. And then, wait, and then
that is
I'm saving
so
these goodies for you.
Crazy.
And then well, when my mom passed away in March 2009, I remember being in my funeral clothes at Ralph's buying like a soda or something because I was just like burned out. And there's an Import Tuner magazine and one of the Fast and Furious movies was coming out. So whatever it was in 2009, I take it off the shelf while I'm waiting to check out. I'm flipping through it. There's an interview with Justin in it. And I go, oh, that's cool, I'm gonna read it. And then they're like, did you have an import car? They asked Justin this. He goes, no. He's like, how do you know about these cars? He said, when I was at UCLA, some students in my class made a documentary about it. And I was like, that's me. That's me. And I bought that import tuner right there off the shelf. Yeah. So there's all these little like connections like that. That's what makes the story. Now you remember it, right? You tell a story. People remember stories, right? This is our anthropological origins. We love stories. We need stories.
I mean, we're
wired for stories, right? I'm not making this up either. This is like Noam Chomsky and like all that.
Sure. This is ethnographic work.
Yeah.
This is what we do, right? This is, you know, major in anthropology at USC. This is, I love this stuff. I love just the connective tissue that, you know, I talked about earlier that, you know, you're part of all these worlds and your professor says, or your mentor says, this is only you. This is only the fingerprint that you can do, that Ki Fong Pa Tran can do.
And I just wanted to say there's two versions of this essay. There's the LA Times version, which is very truncated. And then the original version, so shout out to Aaron and Jackie at Zocalo Public Square. Yeah, that's a 1,700 word version of it. And it's got, in my personal opinion, just a lot more of the original tone.
Spirit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like way more like cheeky and funny and like, and the LA Times really was trying to emphasize the Asian American perspective, which I actually am down for. You know, it took me a little bit of the shift away from more towards like, because it covers Hollywood and stuff like that. But the original title was like A Love Song for My Corolla, which was really like a love song for the 90s, a love song for how we grew up. Like we could, like if I, it's really special for me to talk about the 90s and the early 2000s. Even when I met Kyla Yu last weekend at the book fair, we were talking about it as well. Cause we didn't know how exciting that time was for Asian Americans. And I honestly thought it was gonna last forever. And there is still obviously a
culture
thriving,
out there, yeah.
But when Import Tuner ended and it folded, I think in 2014 or something like that. So even the magazine, so you could tell like the audience, you know, was aging out, I guess, of cars.
And now you go to play basketball with all these 50-year-olds and in the parking lot, there's cars of young people.
The cars
people.
They wanted when they were in their 20s. Yeah,
it's crazy. You know, when I think about the future of literature and Vietnamese American pieces that come out, I am looking forward to the things that you're gonna put out. And
thank you.
Really, really look forward to it. And I want to talk about it a little bit today. Are you down to talk about projects that have not hit the shelves yet?
So the big change in my writing path was in 2019, my writing group my short story group or novel group, we read some science fiction stories. So we read a story by Ted Chiang. And I was like, I like this. And then I started reading more Ted Chiang, and then I started reading like Ken Liu and Carmen Maria Machado. And at the same time, there was an anthology called Best American Science Fiction. It had just come out. So I read that story in 2019, but the anthologies came out in 2017. So it was like the top 20 short stories of that genre. And I was like, could I do that? You know, like, can I switch from like literary fiction to like writing like speculative fiction? And then some of my stories you could tweak, right? I've like kind of like adapted them, and some are original. So my big project is, I'm really proud to say, I am in the Clarion West Novel Writing Workshop. It's like a worldwide workshop with like a longstanding in the speculative community. Just so people will understand, because they might not know what Clarion or Clarion West is.
What is speculative fiction?
Oh, science fiction fantasy. So like robots and space travel and magic and monsters, right? I taught this short story to my students at the same time, Ken Liu's Paper Menagerie, and the students, bro, they didn't just love it, they start crying. When is the last time you see literature? So then I was like, oh, I like that. There's some magic there, yeah, and yeah. I want to see if I can try to do that. Because that's like my audience.
What piece did the students cry? I want to look
Ken Liu's The Paper Menagerie. And you could just look it up for a PDF. It's free online.
Okay.
So I was interested in seeing how I could incorporate those elements into like the Vietnamese diaspora, right? So I don't want to go into like the full... Well, actually, so back to Clarion. Just so people know, because I had to like explain this to like my coworkers and stuff. This is who's taught at Clarion, who's attended. George R.R. Martin, Octavia
the
Butler.
Martian.
Yeah, so like it's the who's who of science fiction writing. Like Stephen Graham Jones, Tanarive.
Big names, yeah.
So it's like an incubator, right? It would be like Film Independence Incubator or Sundance's Labs. So my novel, in short, okay, this is my short pitch, is about werewolves during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And I'll just leave it at that. So there's a lot more to it, but it's a science fiction novel, like supernatural, kind of like X-Files-y.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it makes me feel more free, and I have a lot of fun. It's still very character-based. All the characters are based on historical figures.
How long is it?
It's in three acts. I think it'd be like, try to keep it like 220, like something like that, yeah. So that's like my big project. The workshop goes from March until November. So we should have a draft done by November.
Oh, this is so exciting.
Yeah. But also before that, when we were talking earlier is, I have like, you know, just regular literary ideas set in our world, the world that we grew up with. My other novel is a car novel, like a JDM import car novel. The real pitch for that was The Real Fast and the Furious. That was before this article came out. Yeah. And I was like, because as I stated in the essay, a lot of people in the community, they didn't like that movie because like at the time, here, at least in Southern California, Air California, the only people in the majority of that scene was Asian Americans. And you know by looking at the old videos, the old magazines, all the people that organized it, the parties that we went to. And then when Fast and the Furious comes out, literally like 11 years after the scene, or you know, like the scene is from the 90s, early 90s. And then we don't have one character like be the hero or the main character.
See, I wanted to ask you about that. How do you feel about that? That's Justin Lin. That's a Taiwanese.
No, not the first movie. He didn't do the first movie.
Yeah, but I mean, the next.
But he couldn't help it. After the first movie, the stars were established, right? Mm-hmm. So that once they establish the stars, that's a whole nother animal. That's a sequel. And that's when you start into print money.
Fair.
But the number one is like this underground street racing movie. And we all know it was a very diverse scene. But who were the originators? It's still, without a doubt, I'll go to the grave saying, it's Asian Americans. Oliver Wing, shout out Oliver, wrote Cruising J-Town. There's photos from Gardena, from Venice High yearbooks, with the car crews from the 70s and 80s. And it's like, people want to do this historical revisionism, which is so strange to me, because People made fun. I'm telling you, people made fun of those cars. Those cars were not cool.
Rice rockets. They were not
cool.
Say, you know,
they were not cool. Like, I don't know. Like, there's like a pre Fast and the Furious and a post Fast and the Furious. So how do I feel? I feel like that story's still not told, and I can't wait to do it in novel form at least, because I just think it deserves to be told. There's a real. Again, special world, the Asian American world of the 90s, the flyer parties, like I just think like we were so complex. Like I was saying, like, you don't understand, like there was bad kids back then that were straight A's. There was kids in gangs with straight A's. There's kids, you know, like selling drugs, you know, like doing all the regular teenage thing and then going off to like Berkeley, right? And then that's what's fascinating to me is like they figured out how to do both. We know the same people, and this is a very Vietnamese story. I'm just gonna tell it. This is a Vietnamese podcast. My mom would be like, "You're so bad. Why don't you be like so and so?" And I'd be like, "Do you know what so and so does? I know so and so. These kids jump out their window and go to motel parties." And I'm like, but I'm not a snitch. And I would just sit there like, dang. And I would just be out like playing basketball. And my mom was so hard on me. But I remember the names she was naming would always be like the worst kids. And like that looked so angelic. That was the smoke screen.
There was four of us that were in a party crew. Me and my brother and then another set of brothers, Scott and Son. And we formed a party crew called Trilogy. Mm-hmm. And we did that for like...
That's ironic. There's four of them.
Yes. Always one guy missing.
Yeah.
Always one guy missing. So we formed this party crew and all of us were like really good students. Both my brother and I were in the military. But we were literally dealing with like gangs that were shooting up parties and selling drugs at these parties. And we all had to live a double life in the 90s because you knew you had to do the grades and do well in life. But at the same time, all this other stuff was growing. You know, the street scene was so... I feel like my kids or our kids' generation are going to be losing out on this world, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, texture would be one word for it.
Texture.
But texture would be one word for it, but it's also, you know, we're trying to protect them. We're probably overprotect.
I'm not, though. Well, I'm not. I don't do that. Okay. I don't do that. I curse in front of my kids. I want them to see things that people protect their kids from seeing. I think that you should be seeing that stuff, right? You should be seeing it.
I think you should grow up age appropriate. So whatever you think is age appropriate for the kid, right? Whatever that there should be exposed to.
You think our parents were like, my dad put me behind the steering wheel when I was tall enough to like hit the gas. That was not age appropriate.
That is very, but I think that is a very...
Vietnamese.
I didn't want to say it. I didn't want to say it, but it's different. It's just different. Yeah.
Hood.
No, just like my favorite story is this. Like and this is across all cultures is like, you would go to a family party, right? And now you go to a family party. The kid wants to go to sleep. The family leaves the party now.
Yeah.
Right? Back then, you go to a family party. The kid wants to go to sleep. You go, just go sleep somewhere. Go sleep in the bedroom with all the coats. Go sleep underneath. So my favorite story, this is just a Vietnamese story.
So
true. It's one of my favorite Vietnamese memories. It's really about Vietnamese joy. I'm at my cousin's house, right? The one that like put me on. He taught me basketball. He had the Civic. He you know, had girlfriends. And so we're at the house and I fall asleep. Like underneath the table or something in their den, but the den is cleared out and they're doing cha-cha. I wake up, everybody's been drinking, all the aunties and uncles are doing cha-cha. So that's like the Buddhist side of my family. My Catholic side would never do that, you know? And I see them like, wow, like I'd never seen Vietnamese people, elders having fun and drinking and dancing. And it really was really meaningful to me to like see that side. And they would never really show you that side unless you like fell asleep underneath the table. And like, and I was like, this is so cool. Like it really changed my perspective of like who we are. Like, cause I never would see that on like my parents' side cause they're so like traditional. And it also like relates to this other story like I like to share is I had gone to like a rave at like Avalon, I think, right? And
those are dark days. Avalon's a dark club.
And I you know, we're downstairs. There's a DJ we wanted to see. And then, but I went upstairs, and upstairs is like, is rough. It was all like our aunties and uncles, like 50, 60 years old.
Yeah. On Molly.
Yeah. And I didn't want to be judgmental at all. I was just thinking like, these people live really hard lives. Like they're not living their dream. This is like their party. They have really hard jobs. They probably work some like, you know, 9 to 5 they hate, whatever. And they got to blow off their steam. And but it was a little scary. Like they're, but it was just like, oh, like these are the dimensions of us that we, and unless we tell these stories, right? They're not always positive, but like they make us real.
Yeah.
I think that's like one of our responsibilities for sure.
Paul, my dream is when guests come on, that this is like my living room.
Yeah.
And I want my friends to come back all the time.
For sure.
So when you have these big, it doesn't even have to be big. When you have these like monumental things that happen in your life, book release or whatever, reach out. And, you know, let's get back on. And, you know, once a year, twice a year, we get back on. We shoot the, you know, we shoot the breeze. And
can I give you at least one heads up then?
Please.
So it's July. This October 2026, I'm going to have an exhibit at the Long Beach Main Library, the Billie Jean King Library. The Long Beach, the Arts Council of Long Beach named me a professional artist fellow. It's mostly visual artists, but I got it for the literary arts.
Oh, wow.
So, but they're going to give me gallery space. So I'm working on an exhibit that incorporates writing, multimedia, storytelling, photos. So it would be my, it might be my only ever gallery opening. So I just wanted to say, if you could come to the opening or come and just see the exhibit, it's myself and the other fellows. I think there's 7 of us in total. That's going to be really
That's
exciting.
Great. And we'll put it in the description. A link
in
the description.
Yeah, as soon as the whatever, the release date.
Yeah, we can always update that description. Cool. Exciting. You know, it's after, you know, 30-something years of knowing each other, you know, getting a chance to sit here and discuss all this stuff. And, you know,
it's
such
an honor. It's an honor. I finally did it. I finally cracked the Vietnamese. Only took me 513 episodes.
Thanks for coming on today. Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk very soon once your book hits the shelves next year.
Yeah. Hope so. Hopefully I'll sell it next year.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok @The Vietnamese Podcast.